So, good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Wow. And everyone's still here. I remember once hearing Harada Roshi, a teacher, a Rinzai teacher, who comes to Whidbey Island, there's a center there, saying it's very important to have a retreat place or a temple far enough away from the city that people will not run back to the city right away. Make them stay at least 2 or 3 days, and then they coast. I was also reflecting as I was taking off my mask, I still haven't learned the art of how to take the mask off without removing the glasses halfway as well. There must be a little technique to that. Isn't it beautiful to be here? In the silence, to be here with the wild. It's not often, I think, in most people's lives that we get a chance to really be in the wild. Maybe we drive through it on the way from one city to another. But to live here and live fairly comfortably, what do they call it, glamping in the tents? And here we are enjoying, you know, good food, etc. But still able to absorb, or to be absorbed a little bit at least, in this wild area. I was listening to the CBC one afternoon, fairly recently, just actually maybe about a week ago, and the host interviewed a tree hunter who explained that he and a partner had recently located one of the largest trees in Canada in a very remote area of the Lynn Valley watershed in North Vancouver. They found an ancient western red cedar measuring more than 5.8 meters in diameter, deep, I think it's in the regional park, Headwaters Regional Park, if I remember correctly. Yeah, at any rate, that makes it the fourth largest tree in the country. And we don't know its height yet. They needed to go back with special equipment to be able to accurately measure the height of the tree. So he went on to say that after studying aerial photographs and satellite images, and then spending 10 hours, he and his partner, bushwhacking, 10 hours bushwhacking, through very rugged terrain, they discovered the giant tree in a grove of western red cedars. And they dubbed the tree the North Shore Giant. And he said, you know, given the girth, it's estimated to be at least 1,000 years old, but it could be almost double that. They don't know, and probably may never know, how old it is until it falls down. I don't know, maybe you heard a little bit about that interview. Maybe not. I was very excited to hear it. I love trees. In fact, I have a special affinity, I think, with trees. And to be honest, I'm not sure why, where it comes from. I grew up in Calgary, not known for its trees. And there's aspen, balsam, poplar, white birch, black spruce, white spruce, and some pine. Along with, those are kind of more or less some of the native trees, and then imported, of course, there's some oak, elm, ash, and probably some other things too. But those are the basic trees that I was familiar with growing up. They don't reach the great heights and girths that we see here. And of course, each has its own beauty. Each has its own beauty. But it was only after I had moved as a young man to Vancouver in this area and started hiking that I really became aware of the spiritual force of trees. The giant red cedars, the Douglas firs, hemlocks, always very impressive. But it was the groves of trees, the vast forests along the mountain slopes, that seemed to pull out of my heart a kind of stillness and a reverence. I recently came across a quote by the British poet and writer Kim Taplin, who expresses this love of trees this way. She writes, "Because they are primeval, because they outlive us, because they are fixed, trees seem to emanate a sense of permanence. And although rooted in the earth, they seem to touch the sky. For these reasons, it's natural that we mate, learn wisdom from them." To haunt about them with the idea that if we could read their silent riddle rightly, we should learn some secret vital to our own lives. Or even more specifically, some vital to our real, our lasting, and spiritual existence. Do you feel that a little bit here? I think we all are somewhat familiar with the roles that trees played in the Buddha's life, at least according to the Buddhist lore that we have. His royal mother, Queen Maya, on the way home to her traditional home to give birth, which was the custom in the Indian subcontinent at that time, started to feel birthing pains on her journey home, and had her entourage stop in a sal tree grove. And according to the Buddhist lore, the sutras, it goes like this. When she came to the monarch sal tree of the grove, she took hold, or wanted to take hold of a branch of it, and the branch bending down, like a reed heated by steam, approached within reach of her hand. So stretching out her hand, she took hold of the branch, and then karma-born winds shook her. Her women, drawing a curtain around her, waited. Standing and holding the branch of the sal tree, she was delivered. And then, when the Siddhartha was a young boy, he had his first deep spiritual experience while sitting under the shade of a rose apple tree, watching his royal father engaged in a kind of ritual plowing of the fields. And then much later in his life, as we all know the story, having given up his strong, severe ascetic practices, Siddhartha sat under a tree in a place that we call Bodh Gaya today. And there he took nourishment, giving up his extreme fasting, and sat under a tree for 7 days and nights, when at last he experienced deep awakening, penetrating the deepest truths of existence. And that tree is known as the Bodhi tree, the tree of awakening. And scholars generally believe that it was a variety of fig, a fig tree that is, botanists call it the ficus religiosae. And the early Buddhist writings tell us that the Buddha considered forests to be places good to live and to spend time to meditate in. And very often he would say to his disciples, "Here are the roots of trees. Between are empty spaces. Go there and meditate. That is my instruction to you." And after a long career of teaching, the Buddha, in pain, sickness, in sickness and in pain, and of course near his death, went to Again, a sal tree grove near Kushinagara. And lay down between two great sal trees. And there, shortly before he died, the Buddha addressed his followers, saying, I exhort you, monks and nuns, all fabrications are subject to decay. Bring about completion by being heedful, being aware, being mindful. And those were the Buddha's last words. Imagine what it would be like to die outside while great trees stand watch as you breathe your last few breaths. I, for one, would much prefer that to a hospital room. Our tradition, the Zen tradition, following in the footsteps of the Buddha, perhaps we could say, our tradition also greatly honors trees and the teachings that the trees offer us. So here's one short koan, or instruction. Be an ancient tree in a high wind. Be an ancient tree in a high wind. Kate, yesterday, introduced us to koan practice and gave us a variety of koans that you might select. So here's another one. Be an ancient tree in a high wind. According to the BC government website, old growth is defined as trees that are roughly 250 years old or older. But I think truly ancient trees are much older than that. The ancient trees are ones that have withstood the many challenges of life for centuries. The oldest known tree in Canada is an eastern white cedar that started growing in 688. And it's located not in BC, but in the other side of Canada. It's located in Ontario, in a place called Lion's Head Provincial Park. 688. But it doesn't get the prize for being the oldest tree. The great basin bristlecone pine, which maybe you guys have heard about, in the White Mountains of California, is, according to most scientists, deemed the oldest tree in existence, reaching an age, they speculate, of over 5,000 years old. So already, you know, I just noticed in my talk, I've already mentioned names of a number of trees. Calgary, here. I think it's important that we know the tree names. It's important to see the tree, not just a tree, but to see the tree. I think that's part of coming to know the sentient and insentient beings all around us. Perhaps you've read the book Braiding Sweetgrass by Robin Wall Kimmerer. Heard the name, Braiding Sweetgrass? Beautiful book, highly recommend it. She is an indigenous storyteller, a professor of environmental and forest biology, specializing in mosses. And this is what she wrote about names. I find this very powerful. She says, in indigenous ways of knowing, all beings are recognized as non-human persons, and all have their own names. It is a sign of respect to call a being by its name, and a sign of disrespect to ignore it. To name a thing is to acknowledge its existence as separate from everything else that has a name, to confer upon it the dignity of autonomy while at the same time affirming its belonging with the rest of the nameable world. Isn't that interesting? To transform its strangeness into familiarity, which is the root of empathy. To name is to pay attention. To name is to love. Many years ago, when Kate and I were living in Japan, and we had more or less recently started our living together, in Kyoto particularly, I remember, I had a great interest in all the Buddhist statues that are in Japan. And I had, you know, learned the names and kind of like how to identify them, et cetera, et cetera. But I thought, well, that's good. But then Kate started teaching me the names of birds. I'm very grateful for that. And still, although I'm not very good at birds, I'm very grateful that the ones I know, and I try to learn more. And then, coming back to Canada, she quizzes me sometimes on wild plants, flowers and things. Not very good at that either. But it's lovely and important to know the names. And maybe you've noticed along the trails here, if you've walked, the folks here have placed some signage telling us the names of trees and other plants. So walking on your break, please look at the plants. Look at the name and see that plant as beautifully unique and also as profoundly intimate with all that's around it. They have that lovely little booklet that you can look at as well as you go on your walk. In your free time. This is free time stuff, right? Not break time stuff, not time to do when we're meditating outside. Oh, sorry, I kind of digressed here. Let's go back to the koan. Be an ancient tree in a high wind. This short koan really inspires us to look within, to what is ancient within us. How do you stand upright when buffeted by the winds of this world? When things do not often accord with your desires and your wants. After all, there is no end to what we can worry about, to afterthoughts of regret, to forethoughts of planning, to self-criticism, guilt, longing. And all of this arising mostly from simply our discomfort with our life, wanting it somehow to be different than it is. An ancient tree has experienced the winds and storms of hundreds of years and yet remains upright. Indeed, the bristlecone's success in living a long life can be attributed to, according to the scientists, the harsh conditions that it lives in. Very cold temperatures associated with high winds. Because that allows for a very slow growth rate, which results in very dense wood. And thus, it's able to survive fires, insects, strong winds, etc. Holding steady in a high wind is an image that can motivate us to remain present, I think, in our challenging moments, and to help us when it feels our life is falling apart. Through returning to our stillness and centeredness in this practice, we too remain upright as we endure the weather of our life, maintaining the ground of our being, and maybe even strengthening, like the bristlecone pine. So here at Sea to Sky, we're surrounded by and supported by all the old trees that are around us. And just like these trees, you too have an ancient aspect that is still calm, upright, and undisturbed. Let us bring that forward. In China, pine trees were associated with Buddhist temples, and Buddhist temples were associated with pine trees, especially in the Chan or the Zen tradition. Chan being the Chinese pronunciation of Zen. So these Zen temples in China were usually established on mountains, away from the hustle and bustle of towns and cities. And the custom in China at Zen temples was not to plant flowering trees, mostly because they wouldn't survive the harsh conditions up in the mountains. But to make the temple grounds green and beautiful, the monks and nuns planted pine, cedar, and other kind of evergreens. So here's another koan about pine trees and Zen temples. Linji was planting pine trees with Huangbo when Huangbo asked, "Why are we planting so many trees deep in the mountain?" Linji replied, "First of all, they will become a record of the past for people later on and be of benefit to them. Secondly, to make a good scenery around the main gate." After he finished speaking, he struck the ground 3 times with his hoe. Huangbo picked up his staff and said, "That may be so, but you've already tasted my stick." Linji again struck the ground 3 times with his hoe and sighed out. Huangbo said, "When my teaching line passes on to you, it will prosper greatly in the world." Well, Linji, his full name is Linji Yishuan. In Japanese, it's read Rinzai Gigen. Maybe you're familiar with the name Rinzai a little bit more. So he was a monk, a very famous monk during the Tang Dynasty in China, and credited with founding the Linji or Rinzai school of Zen. And he's famous for a number of really startling statements. That was one of his specialties. Like, he would say, "Become a true person of no rank," or, "If you meet the Buddha, kill him." That kind of stuff. And the other character in this koan is Huangbo, who was Linji's teacher. And Huangbo was famous for his shouting at students and his whacking them over the head with his stick. Oh, and he's also famous for this little story, which I have to share with you. Before the assembly of all his students, he first of all called them a bunch of drunks and said, "Don't you know that in all of China there's not a single Zen teacher?" And then one brave soul from the assembly stepped forward and protested, "But here you are leading and guiding the community. What about you, teacher?" And Huangbo said, "I didn't say there's no Zen, only that there are no teachers of Zen." Idiot. So that's a bit of background on these two characters. So let's go back to the koan for a moment. So Dingji replies to Huangbo that he plants these pine trees to preserve the deep greenness of the mountain temple, so that others who come for training may benefit, and for there to be a cooling green grove just in front of the temple gate. So from that time on, the planting of pines and other evergreens has become a symbol of the Dharma. The Dharma becoming abundant, the Dharma becoming established. And there's a number of sayings about planting pine trees in the tradition. So perhaps when traveling in China or Japan and we see pine trees around the Zen temple, we may think of Dingji. And then here, at Sea to Sky, when we look around at the great cedars, hemlocks, Douglas firs that we see here, maybe we can think of the indigenous peoples whose careful stewardship of this land we benefit from today. So after Dingji gives his answer, he struck the ground three times with his hoe. And I think he was kind of saying, oops, I said too much. I shouldn't have gone to all of that detail. And Huangbo, his teacher, challenges him by picking up his staff and says, that may be so, but you've already tasted this stick. And I think Huangbo is saying, well, all right, but are you stopping there, telling me all the good works that you're piling up? Remember, I've got my stick here. You better go a bit further. But Dingji does not offer any words, but again struck the ground three more times with his hoe. And I think Dingji is acknowledging that the Lingji of piling up good works is no longer there. It's just Buddha nature, compassionately making great effort in the world. Just like the trees all around us here at Sea to Sky, growing up to whatever height they will reach, giving themselves completely and diligently to being tree life, expressing tree life. In that same way, the disciple Dingji is just practicing wholeheartedly without expectations. Speculation and outcomes, calculating results, have nothing to do with swinging that hoe, or I guess it would be more like a mattock, right? Kind of a big hoe, and then planting a sapling. Trees teach us about wholehearted activity. I think we've all seen trees grow, or trying to grow, saplings grow, where they're not going to flourish. But they grow there anyway. Near our home, Kate and I walk along a creek called Kanaka Creek sometimes. It's a watercourse that has some pretty steep banks. And after a heavy period of rain, we sometimes see fairly big trees that have fallen off the cliff face into the creek. Is this a gain or a loss? I don't know. I wonder at times what is being nourished as the tree gradually breaks apart and is swept downstream into the Fraser River. Dingji's planting of trees, not knowing how many will survive or thrive, I think reflects our practice. Maybe you already feel this way. Not knowing what will arise as we settle down onto our cushion or chair, we simply make our wholehearted effort to return to the present moment of body and breath. And every day, we repeatedly take care of our body, right? We wash it. We take care of our dirty dishes, clean the bathrooms, do whatever work is necessary, even though we know we have to do the whole thing over again. The next day, and then the next day. These activities that we do are also zazen, offered for the benefit of all. Like Rinji, we may imagine something like he imagined, maybe a green grove in front of the temple gate. We may imagine something from our work. But let our work and activity be done with a spacious mind, not in a hurry. Let it be done as an expression of gratitude, rather than with an expectation of a result. I mentioned falling trees at Kanaka Creek, so I thought I'd give you one more koan to stew on, if you wish. A monk asked Yunmen, Kate talked a little bit about Yunmen yesterday, I think. A monk asked Yunmen, how is it when the tree withers and the leaves fall? And Yunmen replied, body exposed in the golden wind. So this short koan comes from the Blue Cliff Record, a collection of koans from China, but I'm not giving you any information about the monk. But I wonder what you think of his question. How is it when the tree withers and the leaves fall? Is he asking about impermanence, or is it something else? When all the large and small storms are over, when droughts and fires have come and gone, and all the leaves have fallen and the branches are bare, what is it like? Here we are surrounded by lush green and vibrant trees, but what does a dying or dead tree evoke for you? Maybe this monk is asking about the falling away of things and the suffering that this causes. We all know everything will fall away. And as we get older, we know the truth of this even more. But his teacher, the great Yunmen, answers, body exposed in the golden wind. Now in China, gold was the color associated with autumn. And autumn, in turn, is associated with abundance. Seems odd. Eh? Withered tree, no leaves, and abundance? Perhaps Yunmen is telling his student to see that when we see the truth of impermanence clearly and deeply without prejudice, that is when we deeply rest in the truth of all things. Or perhaps the monk's inquiry is about our mind, our awareness, when we have, at least for a little while, put down all our suffering from our desires and attachments of life, when the ignorant and greedy and angry tendencies have become quiet and we're no longer scattered, grabbing for this or that. When our mind instead is spacious and open, calm. Maybe the monk is asking, how is that? And maybe this week you'll touch on that place. Now and again. But maybe right now we're still at that point of dropping off the leaves of thought and stuff. Mm-hmm. Often at the beginning of retreat or zazen, we think about this and that. We notice all kinds of problems. But as we continue our practice, our sitting in the zazen, we continue to align with our body. We continue to align with our breath. the body and our breathing become settled. Our awareness becomes a little more spacious, open, calm. And the strong winds of our life blow less. Body exposed in the golden wind, Yunmen replied. What is it that is exposed when everything is blown away in the golden wind? That golden wind that has been blowing from the beginning of time and is blowing right now, right here. In those quiet moments of your sitting, who experiences that spacious and open calm? What is that body that is exposed in the golden wind of silence and stillness? Well, Kate will tell you the answer tomorrow.